Year's War by David Irving. The Major Solution. Overwhelmingly German in history and inclination, the port of Danzig was put under League of Nations mandate by the victors at Versailles. The Poles, as protecting power, had certain rights, including diplomatic, passport, and military offices. The railway system, about 120 customs officials, and a large post office building were Polish too. If and when Hitler did launch White, Danzig would be vulnerable for several days, as General Feder von Bock, commanding Group Army North, warned. He recommended on May 27, 1939, to the General Staff that a secret brigade should be illicitly raised from the 12,000 Germans with military experience in Danzig and from the city police. He also suggested that on the actual day of White, a German naval force might happen to be visiting Danzig. It could disembark a battalion of troops to secure the city. Hitler approved Bock's outline on June 11th. A major general, Friedrich George Eberhardt, was sent in plain clothes to organize a free corps there. Shiploads of guns and ammunition, ostensibly bound for Königsberg, suffered engine problems en route, and docked for repairs at Danzig, where Eberhardt's gear, everything from a shoe nail to a 150mm gun, was unloaded under cover of darkness. The SS came for a sports display in Danzig, but the SS troops stayed on afterward. By the time of White, Eberhardt would command two infantry regiments, an artillery battalion, and SS irregulars, too. Bridges were strengthened, barracks built, pontoon sections stockpiled. Hitler boasted in private, quote, "I was owed 100 Reichsmarks. I've already collected 99, and I'm going to get the last coin, too," unquote. He authorized Goebbels to deliver a powerful and provocative speech in Danzig on June 17th. Goebbels confidently briefed Nazi editors, quote, "This is to be a trial balloon, to test the international atmosphere on the settlement of the Danzig question," unquote. Berlin began to swelter. On July 3rd, Hitler and Goering visited a secret display of new Luftwaffe equipment at Recklin Air Station. They showed Hitler an experimental Heinkel rocket-propelled fighter. A Heinkel 111 bomber, heavily overloaded, was lifted seemingly effortlessly into the air by rocket-assisted takeoff units. He saw the latest early warning radar pressurized cabins for high-altitude planes. In the laboratory, they demonstrated to him simple methods of starting motor engines in sub-zero temperatures, and the new 30mm cannon installed in a Messerschmitt 110 fighter in the firing butts. It was all just a grandiose self-deception, and it had fatal consequences. Hitler decided to grab a much bigger bite of Poland, apart from just Danzig and the corridor. In May 1942, Goering would exclaim, quote, "The Führer took the most serious decisions on the basis of that display. It was a miracle that things worked out as well as they did, and that the consequences were not far worse," unquote. As the sun climbed higher that summer, Hitler's ministers fled Berlin. Over dinner on July 4th, he agreed with his propaganda minister that they should now nurture hatred towards Britain, and that the German people must learn to recognize the British as their principal obstacle. On the 9th, Ribbentrop left to vacation at Lake Fussel, near the Berghof. Brauchitsch attended Army Day celebrations at Karlhorst that day, then left for several weeks' furlough. Goering was cruising down the canals in his yacht. Hitler could afford to wait. He knew that the Reich had most to offer Stalin in return for a pact. In mid-June 1939, the Soviets had again obliquely hinted, this time through the Bulgarian envoy in Berlin, that they would prefer dealing with the Reich, provided that Hitler would sign a non-aggression pact. He told Goebbels on July 8th that it was unlikely that London and Moscow would ever reach agreement. Quote, "That leaves the way open for us," unquote, concluded the propaganda minister. Meanwhile, Hitler took direct control of every phase of the strategic preparations, dealing with Heydrich, Goebbels, and, as he lacked a naval adjutant, the Admiralty in person. Albert Forster, Gauleiter of Danzig, appeared several times at the Berghof. On July 13th, he had what his newspaper Danziger Vorposten called a lengthy, quote, "a lengthy discussion," unquote, with Hitler. After another meeting, a week later, Forster told his own staff, quote, "The Führer says that he was inclined just to tackle Danzig this summer, but common sense has now dictated that the settlement of this matter should be linked to a solution of the German-Polish problem as a whole at a suitable time, unquote. Forster described the solution now desired as being to regain the Reich's eastern frontiers as they had been in 1914. On July 22nd, Hitler telephoned the Admiralty and ordered it to be ready to send the elderly cruiser Nuremberg to Danzig at short notice. 2 days later, on July 24th, 1939, he drove to Beirut for his annual Wagner pilgrimage. Here he wallowed in a Wagner orgy, the Flying Dutchman, Parsifal, and the whole of the Ring. In his youth, Hitler had been a chorister at Lambach in Upper Austria. As a romantic, rootless youth of 17, he had scraped and saved to visit the opera at Linz, and it was seeing Wagner's early opera Rienzi in 1906 that had first stirred Hitler's alter ego, the demagogue slumbering within the artist. In a way, Rienzi was almost destined to become Hitler's own story. He recognized this in 1945, and he recited to Schaub the lines from the opera, which he desired to be inscribed on his mausoleum. Rienzi is a true story of the Roman plebs, who were suppressed by the unscrupulous nobili until the young notary Rienzi, 1313-1354, rises from their midst in an unknown citizen who rallies and liberates and leads them until the very nobili themselves proclaim him their master. Quote, Rienzi, hail! Hail to you, the people's tribune! Unquote. Later, the nobili conspire. Even the faithful desert Rienzi and the hand that strikes him down comes from his own ranks. Hitler had been electrified on first hearing the Rienzi trauma in 1906. He left the theater long after midnight with his school friend, August Kubicek, and scaled a hill outside Linz. Here Hitler suddenly spoke of a pact that the people would one day make with him, to lead them out of their subjugation, to the pinnacles of freedom. He spent the night in the open air. His friend Kubicek might well have challenged him. Quote, Rienzi, hey, what do you plan? I see you mightily before me. Tell, wherefore needst thou this new might? Unquote. He did not, but he met Hitler again 33 years later in Beirut in July 1939 when they dined together at Frau Winifred Wagner's home, quote, Wagnfried, unquote, and here he reminded Hitler of that night on the Austrian hillside. Hitler interrupted, turned to Frau Wagner, and poured out the whole story. Quote, that was when it all began, unquote, he told them. Hitler patronized the arts as had few of his more recent predecessors. He had heard Die Meistersinger 40 times. Schaub believed it was Hitler's favorite because it was a paean, to German craftsmanship. Quote, Wagnfried in Beirut was like a home away from home to Hitler. Frau Wagner, a matronly English woman, widow of the great composer's son, was like a second mother to him. From 1925 to 1933, Hitler had kept away from Beirut to spare her any embarrassment. Then he had reestablished the friendship, frequently telephoning her under his private nickname of, quote, Bandleader Wolf, unquote. This remarkable dowager's admiration for Hitler would not diminish until her death. Sometimes she used her friendship to intercede on behalf of Jews or persecuted musicians. Hitler explained that she would have to write to him through Dr. Karl Brandt, quote, If your letters fall into the hands of Reichsleiter Bormann, he said, there's no guarantee that they'll reach me, unquote. While Hitler stayed at Beirut in July 1939, the foreign clamor mounted. Ambassador Herbert von Dirksen reported from London that the British press had been crying rape ever since the annexation of Austria. What interested Hitler more was that authoritative voices could now be heard from London indicating that Chamberlain was casting around for ways of divesting himself of the awkward guarantee given to Poland. Hitler had mentioned to Walter Huell as recently as June, after King George VI had replied warmly to Hitler's condolences on the loss of the submarine Thetis, that if only he could meet some Englishman of standing with whom he could talk in German, he could soon settle their country's remaining differences. By late July, the signs were that Chamberlain and his advisers were preparing for a second Munich. On a British initiative, there had been talks between Sir Horace Wilson, one of the main appeasers among Chamberlain's advisers, and one of Goering's economic staff, Dr. Helmuth Wohlthat. Wilson had proposed a sweeping political, economic, and military agreement with Hitler. in return for certain assurances. Quote, "Perhaps I'm too much of an optimist," the Englishman said, "and perhaps the solution does seem unrealistic to many observers in the present situation, but I have had the opportunity of studying the Führer, and I believe that the Führer, acting as a statesman for peace, can manage even greater achievements than he already has in his construction of Grossdeutschland." Unquote. The OKW timetable for White would soon come into force. Admittedly, no military decisions of significance were required until August 12th, but the General Staff had determined that the optimum date for attacking Poland would be August 25th, and Hitler was required to decide for or against White on the 15th. This left barely 2 weeks for him to obtain Stalin's signature on a pact, and nobody believed that Ribbentrop would manage such a feat in time. Quote, "I don't believe the Moscow talks will prove a flop," unquote, wrote Wiesacker in his diary on July 30th. Quote, "but nor do I believe they can be concluded in the next 14 days, as we are now attempting. My advice is that we should resort to blunter language in Moscow about the partition of Poland. Ribbentrop suggests talking to Moscow about sharing the Baltic states so that north of the latitude of Riga should be Russia's Lebensraum and south of it ours. But I advise against this," end quote. Hitler stayed at Bayreuth, troubled only by the affairs of his party henchmen. He predicted to Goebbels on July 25th that the democracies would shrink back from war step by step, and that Warsaw too would crumble when push came to shove. Goebbels was in a state of high nerves, but for family reasons. His wife Magda had thrown herself into a sorrowing liaison with his young and handsome state secretary at the propaganda ministry, Karl Honka. Hitler again angrily forced a reconciliation between the couple and required them to attend the next day's opera together. But of all operas, that night's offering was the romantic tragedy Tristan und Isolde, and Frau Goebbels openly blubbered while Hitler and his white-faced propaganda minister affected not to notice. Robert Ley, the Labour Front leader, tormented Hitler in a different way. In Winifred Wagner's exquisite drawing room, he proposed that at the coming Nuremberg rally they should dispense with the customary fanfare from Verdi's Ida and play instead a little piece which he, Ley, had composed for the occasion. He modestly played a gramophone record of the fanfare. After the last fearsome strains died away, Hitler tersely announced, "We'll stick to Ida," unquote. It was here at Bayreuth that Hitler jovially buttonholed Neurath with the words, quote, "You're going to be astonished by what I'm going to tell you. What do you say we come to an agreement with Russia?" Unquote. Neurath was indeed stunned, but responded favorably. Hitler ventured, quote, "It will probably be hard to reconcile my party stalwarts to the move," unquote. Neurath flattered him, quote, "The party is like putty in your hands, mein Führer," unquote. Hitler still feared a snub from the Soviet dictator, however, and time was running out. Acting on his instructions, on August 2nd, Ribbentrop hinted to the Soviet chargé d'affaires that Moscow and Berlin ought to decide Poland's fate between them, and he added the tempting bait that there was, quote, "no problem between the Baltic and the Black Sea," unquote, that could not be solved between them. Ribbentrop emphasized that Germany was in no hurry yet, a poker-faced assurance that must have been torture to utter, given the rigid timetable already imposed by the OKW's planning. The clock was already ticking, but Moscow must not hear it. Hitler left Bayreuth on August 3rd, toured the Nuremberg Arena, as though nothing would prevent the party rally from opening here in 1 month's time, and drove down the Autobahn to Munich on the 4th. At his Munich apartment, he changed into a dark blue suit and received General Keitel in the drawing room. The OKW chief had brought with him the final timetable for White. The army still wanted X day to be on August 25th, as mid-September rains might bog down panzer operations in Poland and set the German Air Force at a disadvantage. Hitler motioned Keitel and his staff officer, Major Bernd von Lossberg, into easy chairs and explained to them once more in an affable Austrian dialect, which rather surprised Lossberg, just why the Polish problem had to be settled now. He blamed Chamberlain's thoughtless guarantee to Poland for stiffening Warsaw's opposition. Quote, the gentlemen in London and Paris won't undertake anything against us this time either, unquote, he assured the officers. Then his Austrian dialect vanished, submerged in a sudden cresting wave of familiar, guttural Hitler German. Quote, I will see to that. This Polish conflict will never, never, never result in a European war, unquote. He drove on that evening to the Berghof, and this was to be the scene of the next 3 weeks' momentous events. From London, the signs were again conciliatory. Neville Chamberlain had adjourned Parliament on August 4th for 2 months. Simultaneously, he risked a strange move that further convinced Hitler that Britain was not yet ready to fight. Sir Horace Wilson invited Ambassador Herbert von Dirksen to call at his private flat in Chelsea, specifying that he should come on foot so as not to attract attention, and outlined an offer for a, quote, full-bodied political world partnership, unquote, between Britain and Germany. If Hitler would accept the terms, Wilson indicated, then Britain would put pressure on Poland to agree to Germany's demands. Thus, the awkward British guarantee to Poland would become inoperative. Ribbentrop received Dirksen's astounding telegram on his talk on this talk soon after. Wiesacker noted on the 6th, quote, underground feelers from Chamberlain toward a compromise, via Horace Wilson, proved that a dialogue with Britain could be got going if we so desired, unquote. Hitler was not inclined to bend, however. Secret directives went to the Nazi press on the 12th and the 13th, forbidding them to mention Britain's apparent change of heart. Quote, Britain incited the Poles, now she must pay the price, unquote, was the official line to be taken. Editors were commanded to observe, quote, absolute discipline, unquote, on this posture. Britain's talks with Stalin must have reached a deadlock. Of this, Hitler was convinced. He detailed a Nazi agent to stand by at Croydon Airfield, London, as the British chief negotiator, William Streng, flew back from Moscow on August 7th. Streng's dejected look betrayed that Hitler's surmise was probably correct. On the 9th, Halifax himself spoke to Dirksen. This time, he promised that Britain was willing to go, quote, a long way, unquote, toward meeting Germany's desires. But Hitler's central desire now was to have what he called his little war with Poland. After his intelligence chief Canaris conferred on August 10th with Keitel and Schmunt at Salzburg, and then with Ribbentrop at Fusel, Lieutenant Colonel Erwin Lehosen wrote in his diary, quote, intimations of a non-aggression pact with R, unquote, meaning Russia. On August 11th, Hitler ordered the anti-Polish propaganda volume turned up to, quote-unquote, 80% of its full volume. After months of maintaining a studied silence in the Nazi press about the Polish, quote-unquote, atrocities, on the 16th, editors were secretly circularized. Quote, the time has come for the German press to abandon its reserve, unquote. Goebbels ordered Polish, quote-unquote, terrorist incidents moved from page 2 to page 1. Though still only modestly displayed, and there was to be no mention yet of Germany's territorial claims. Hitler needed reliable staged, quote-unquote, incidents at a closely defined place, time, and date. He had a tight OKW schedule to meet. Two diabolical schemes had been drafted by SS Obergruppenführer Reinhard Heydrich, quote, following long-standing patterns set by our Western neighbors, as he explained to SS commanders on about the 11th. Oh, end quote. In one, his agents would masquerade as Polish insurgents, seize the German transmitter station at Gliwice, broadcast a proclamation, and then escape. In the other, more complex incident, a company of Polish-speaking idealists would be recruited from the upper Silesian workforce, dressed in Polish uniforms on the eve of white, and ordered to, quote-unquote, seize a German customs post near Hochlinden. A mock battle would be staged with SS troops, while real Polish troops would be lured into the fray from their garrison at nearby Rybnik by a Polish officer who had recently defected to Germany. The Gestapo chief, Heinrich Müller, also hit on the macabre idea of strewing fresh corpses, condemned convicts from Dachau, on the quote-unquote battlefield, equipped with genuine Polish soldiers' passbooks. When Hitler talked with Professor Karl Burkhardt, the League of Nations High Commissioner in Danzig on the 11th, he had prepared the way by underlining the point, quote, "If there's the slightest provocation, I shall shatter Poland without warning into so many pieces that there will be nothing left to pick up." End quote. He boasted that whereas in 1938 he had had to whip his generals on, this year he was having to hold them back. Hitler continued and recalled Burkhardt years later, quote, "Everything I'm doing is directed against Russia. If the West is too obtuse to grasp this, then I'll be forced to come to terms with the Russians and turn against the West first, after which I'll direct my entire strength against the USSR." End quote. The next day, Hitler made much the same point to Count Galeazzo Ciano, Mussolini's foreign minister, that he proposed one day to tread the old Teutonic road toward the east, as he had told the Duce himself aboard the Conte Cavour in May 1938. Excuse the dog noises in the background. The Italians were still unaware of White, the plan to invade Poland. Quote, "For the first time," wrote Wiesacker in his diary, "we're finding the Italian alliance a nuisance, because over the last week, our, i.e. Hitler's, will to war has become much stronger. Himmler, Ribbentrop, and Gulliter-Forster have each been promoting the idea of war on their own spheres. Ribbentrop is guaranteeing that the British and French will remain neutral, provided we can deal annihilating blows to Poland in the first 3 days. This, he thinks, is certain." Unquote. Count Ciano was received at the Berghof on August 12th. Eva Braun, confined upstairs, later pasted a sequence of snapshots into her album showing the swirl and flourish of arriving limousines, black-shirted fascist leaders greeting Hitler, and some of them even glancing up to her window. She girlishly captioned the photos, quote, "Up there, there's something forbidden to behold. Me," unquote. Hitler had little time or liking for Ciano. He told Schaub that the Italian was, quote, "too brilliantined and dandified," unquote, to inspire trust. Hitler spoke about Germany's strength and Britain's overwhelming vulnerability to air attack. This was all probably meant for English ears. He would say at a conference on May 20th, 1943, quote, "Every memorandum I wrote to the Duce reached Britain immediately after, so I only wrote him what I wanted the British to know without fail," unquote. It seems clear that Hitler, quote, confidently, unquote, informed Ciano that White would start in 2 weeks' time because the British Foreign Office learned of this a few days later. Ciano was astounded. Hitler assured Ciano that the West would not intervene, but he did not explain why. The Nazi-Soviet pact. Even as Ciano was uncomfortably remonstrating with Hitler in the Great Hall, a door was flung open and Walter Huell hurried in. He whispered to Ribbentrop. Ribbentrop took Hitler aside and whispered to him. Molotov had just agreed in principle to receive a German negotiator in Moscow. Hitler's mood changed. With a broad grin, he invited the fascist guest to accompany him up to his tea house, Eyrie, the Eagle's Nest. Curiously, Baron von Wiesacker also appeared to have been left in the dark at first about the news from Moscow. The likely reason was that Wiesacker was communing treacherously closely with the ambassadors of Britain, France, and Italy. On the 13th, he wrote, quote, "My own formula remains unchanged. If Poland commits a provocation of such effrontery that Paris and London will also recognize it as such, then we can set about her. We can set about her. Otherwise, we should keep our hands off. I am still not quite clear," continued Wiesacker in some puzzlement on the 14th, "just what has brought about this somersault at Fusel, Ribbentrop's summer home, and the Berghof. A week ago, they still inclined to view that the Western powers would not drop Poland, so we could not tackle her." End quote. Hitler hesitated for several days before responding to Moscow, but the OKW timetable had him in its vice. Important decisions were due on the 15th. The latest intelligence reports showed that Britain had offered Poland an £8 million loan, and that Polish mobilization preparations were far in advance of his own. On August 14th, Hitler called his three commanders-in-chief to the Berghof and explained why White was still on and why he was sure that the Western powers would not declare war. General Sir Edmund Ironside had submitted a scathing report on Polish combat readiness. Hitler guessed that Chamberlain would use it as an alibi to ditch the Poles. Were Britain really in earnest, she would have offered Poland more than a measly £8 million loan. Quote, "The British don't sink money in an unsound business," end quote. And the Poles in turn would be more insolent than FA intercepts of late revealed. Hitler said that his only worry was that the British might yet cheat him of White by making some last-minute offer. He told Goering, Brauchitsch, and Raeder on this day that he had hinted to the British that he would approach them again with an offer of his own later, after he had dealt with Poland. Raeder, still in a huff over the Albrecht affair, did not speak, nor did Brauchitsch. Canaris wrote in his diary, quote, "Commander-in-Chief Army didn't get a word in edgeways," unquote. Hitler now took a further fateful step. At 10:53 p.m. that evening, August 14th, Ribbentrop cabled these dramatic instructions to the embassy in Moscow. Molotov was to be informed that he, Ribbentrop, was willing to come to Moscow in person. His State Secretary Wiesacker correctly reflected, quote, "If Ribbentrop manages to conclude a pact, they," that is the Russians, "will thereby be inviting us to attack Poland," end quote. On the 15th, Hitler authorized all the timetable steps consistent with an attack on Poland on the 25th. The armed forces were ordered to assume that White will be on. The Navy ordered the pocket battleships Graf Spee and Deutschland and 14 submarines to stand by for operations into the Atlantic. The Nuremberg rally was secretly canceled to release railroad capacity for the Wehrmacht, but foreign diplomats were still fed with the impression that the rally was on. Less well documented are the murkier operations planned by the Abwehr and SS. They had prepared commando-style operations to secure vital bridges, tunnels, and industrial plants behind the Polish lines on the very eve of White. The Abwehr had trained a task force to seize the 300-yard-long railroad tunnel at Jabłonka. On the main line from Vienna to Warsaw, period. If the Poles could detonate the demolition charges in the twin tunnel, it would bar the entry into southern Poland of Wilhelm List's 14th Army, now massing in Slovakia. Hitler piously insisted on a clear distinction between these quote-unquote illegals and regular German army units when Manstein asked permission to operate three assault groups in Polish uniforms during Army Group South's attack. Hitler turned him down. Himmler then asked for permission for the SS to use Polish uniforms in precisely the same area, and on August 17th, Hitler gave him his blessing and ordered the Abwehr to release 150 Polish uniforms from its stock to Heydrich for the purpose. At the northern end of the Polish front, Hitler personally conceived an adventurous operation to secure the two strategic bridges across the River Vistula at Dershow. Each bridge had its eastern end on Danzig soil and its western end footed on Polish ground, Pomerania. Obsessed with the Dershow bridges, Hitler studied air photographs and models and devised plan after plan. Eventually, he agreed with Goering, Himmler, and Brauchitsch on a heavy dive bomber attack on the Polish bridge garrison. The local power station and the demolition fuses themselves, followed up immediately by a ground assault. A goods train would arrive from East Prussia in the last minutes before White began, laden with concealed sappers and storm troops under Lieutenant Colonel Gerhard Medem. Hitler briefed him personally. Timing was crucial, since the attack had to coincide exactly with the Luftwaffe strike against the Polish naval base at Gdynia, the first overt act of White. Unquote. The elderly warship Schleswig-Holstein was moved to Danzig. When White began, she would immediately bombard the Polish stronghold emplaced, illegally, on the Westerplatte, the silvery sliver of land commanding the entrance to the harbor. Inevitably, the Russians began to dither. After Molotov formally proposed, on August 16th, a non-aggression pact, Ribbentrop promptly replied with the suggestion that he visit Moscow in 2 or 3 days' time to sign it. The Russians dragged their feet. On August 18th, Ribbentrop telegraphed his ambassador urging speed and mentioned alluringly that he would be authorized to sign a secret additional protocol codifying aspects too delicate for public consumption. Even so, Molotov seemed unwilling to receive him in Moscow before August 26th or 27th. As Ribbentrop well knew, the OKW timetable was geared to launching White on or soon after the 25th. The political effect of the pact would be nil if it were not signed well before then. In fact, the A movement, the initial transfer of 220 trainloads to assemble military equipment and troops in the East, was already beginning. To Hitler, it seemed a proper occasion for taking a personal risk. Quote, "Our opponents still hoped," he bragged 2 days later, "that Russia would emerge as our enemy after we had defeated Poland. But our opponents had not taken my power of decision into account. Our opponents are little worms. I saw them all at Munich," end quote. On August 20th, he took the unprecedented and flattering step of writing a personal note to Stalin, asking him to accept Ribbentrop's presence in Moscow not later than 3 days from now. Frightened by his own boldness, Hitler could not contain his nervousness after that. He telegraphed Goering in the small hours. He snarled uneasily at Ribbentrop for having tempted him out onto this trembling limb of high diplomacy. But during the afternoon of August 21st, word came from Moscow. His ambassador had been summoned to see Molotov at 3 p.m. More anguished hours passed. At last, Ribbentrop brought the ambassador's report. A smile lit up Hitler's face. A photographer was summoned to capture the moment as he read the telegram. The Kremlin would be happy to receive Herr Ribbentrop in 2 days' time, as Hitler had requested. An air of celebration gripped the Berghof as though a great victory had been won. And in a sense it had, for when German radio interrupted its programs at 11:15 p.m. to broadcast this chilling news to the world, nobody could doubt that it spelled the end for Poland. Quote, "Now," Hitler said triumphantly to his commanders the next morning, "now I have Poland just where I want her," end quote.